Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Hello and welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. I'm delighted to have our first guest of the year, Tara Nolan. Tara's an analytic network coach and has long experience working with teams. Tara has her own podcast called The Game of Teams, and she completed her 50th episode recently. Tara, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you today?
Oh, thank you, Simon. And thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm really well. I've started the year in a positive way. I appreciate there's so much suffering going on around, but I'm good. I'm a really good place, and I'm looking forward to 2021.
Good. So we decided to work together today and think about teams. You've spoken to some great guests over your 50 episodes, and I wanted to ask you, what have you learned over that time? It's a big question. Let's start with a big question. What have you learned over the last 50 episodes about teams and teamwork?
I think it's a great question, and I have learned loads. And I deliberately formed my podcast to be a mix of leaders operating in organizations, working directly with teams, and also to interview practitioners who, you know, offer their services to teams to support teams be more effective and more collaborative in nature. And I guess there have been many themes that have, you know, cut across those 50 episodes. And I tend to bucket them into three forms, which is, you know, the structure of a team and getting the basic structure of a team correct. So, you know, one kind of the, is it a team or is it a group? And what's the purpose of the team? And how are the team members' strengths enabled in the composition of the team to support the team's purpose? And all the various then enablers that make a team work, like, importantly, you know, team norms and team agreements. And then, importantly, which I'm not sure a lot of individual coaches may attend to, but you have to as a team coach, the idea of group dynamics and understanding, you know, all the conscious and unconscious happenings on a team, and how a team, you know, and team members are invariably looking to belong into the system. They're looking for some measure of competence, and they're looking for a measure of authority autonomy in that, and you have to be very careful in noticing all of those to sense the tensions and the unspoken biases, preferences, etc., and assumptions that are working on a team. And finally, then, how a team gets into action and some of the decision making and processes and the tripwires that happen on teams, that, you know, the power authority structure isn't articulated and it can lead to many gaffes. So I've been really informed in over the course of the 50 episodes as to what constitutes a good team and how to exercise a good team, and then the experiences and stories that people have had. And I've been left in no doubt that it's complex, it's messy, it takes time, and it is never just a half day fix.
That's true enough. Yeah. No, I mean, it's very rich what you're sharing, and it's interesting because I came to this from my background, psychotherapy, you know, family therapy. So, and I did a lot of group therapy when I was working in a therapeutic community with young people. And it begs the question, kind of, what is the difference between a group and a team? What constitutes a team as opposed to a group? And what dynamics are similar and what are different between the two? Have you got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the thing about a team is that it needs to have a shared purpose, whereas a group doesn't have to, and they can learn from each other. And but the purpose is often not the same. And I think, you know, having expectations to deliver desired outcomes is often shared in a team and not in a group, and they can be very individually focused. And again, the group just, you know, uses each other to learn from each other or have different purposes and at different points in time. And, it, you know, I think it's an important question to address on a team. It's one of the first questions I asked, does this team, you know, this entity need to be a group or a team? Because it's a lot of energy then to work as a team, to coalesce, to collaborate, to coordinate, to communicate, to dialogue, versus the needs of a group. So I think it's an important differentiator.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the, another thing which bonds a team, I mean, when I think about a team, I think of bonding, and I think about trust, and I think about identity, you know. So identity is vital to this question as well, isn't it? So a group may or may not have its identity, but a team has to have an identity, doesn't it?
I totally agree. In fact, I think, you know, when we're looking to think about what's extraordinarily important to get a performance, you know, the kind of the psychological safety that you alluded to already, team identity, and then constructive dialogue, those three things, you know, are kind of what you're looking for. That's the nirvana, if you can. Because if you have those three, you know, well articulated, like what is our team identity? You know, what do we stand for? Who are we? What are we proud of, et cetera? And then how do we go about having that dialogue and that understanding to get at that identity? And similarly, have in place the psychological safety elements, then you've got the potential for a high performing team.
Yeah, and I think speaking as coaches and supervising and training many, many coaches all over the world, my experience is that coaching actually has a big lack here. Like there's it's nearly always organized around individuals, you know, apart from kind of specific team coaching approaches. And there's a mentality of coaches and often of people in organizations, you know, that it's about me, it's about my performance, it's about kind of how I show up. It's about my behaviors, and the team is pushed into the distance. It's there, but it's in the distance. Do you experience that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. And I think when I'm engaged with teams, there's also that supposition made that I'm going to go then and individually work with each member, and in conversation I'll be, you know, coaching individuals and, you know, with everybody looking. I think you have to first of all have the mindset as a team coach that the team is an entity. It with its own personality and identities you've just shared, and that it has responsibility for the team, and there are team needs, and of course individuals contribute to it, but you don't lose sight of the entity that is the team and its purpose and what it has to deliver for the organization. So I think, you know, you're on a sort of hiding to nothing if you start out with a sort of, because you'll be operating in it as group coaching if you go in on the individual premise. And it's one of the things that I have to surface very quickly, that the team is my client and I'm coaching the entity. I'm not coaching the individuals.
Yeah, I think that's really important. My work is psychoanalytically based, as you know, and I work with group relations, a way of working with groups and organizations as a whole, as a system. And the work emanates from... part of it emanates from Wilfred Bion, a psychoanalyst working at a Tavistock clinic, who studied groups and group psychology, another psychoanalyst, Fulks, did the same. And they worked on the premise of a group as a whole, which is very similar to what you're saying. So you take the group as a whole. And what Bion said, that he studied the groups with binocular vision, and he looked at a group through two lenses, one, the individual in the group, and then the group as a whole.
Yeah.
And he noticed group as the whole cultures and unconscious cultures, how groups would move from dependency cultures to flight cultures, and almost as if they had a life of their own. And I think you're sharing that. You see that in your teamwork as well, isn't it?
I absolutely do. And sometimes, I mean, I had a very fabulous privilege of doing a group analysis with Dr. Susan Long, Professor Susan Long, just before Christmas. And it really brought home to me that idea of Bion's work and what's involved in that, and all the stuff that goes underneath. But as you spoke there about dependency, about fight or flight, and what the group takes on and doesn't. And that's so important as a team coach, to have an appreciation of that is happening on a team, you know, and, you know, to be reminded of it in the absence of a task, because we're so busy with task and stuff that we get distracted from the very goings on of a team. And what's maybe stymieing its progress or getting in the way or frustrating efforts or, you know, causing hiccups. So I think that group understanding, group relations and group dynamics is really important for teams.
It's vitally important, and paying attention to process as well as content and to task. People think it wastes time or takes up too much time, but in my experience, it enhances the work incredibly. I put this to test myself. I was recently chief executive president of a not-for-profit organization working with a board. And previously, I'd been on the board for a few years, and we'd kind of meet in a hotel. It's an international group, and we meet at different venues twice a year. And the process usually was kind of a breakfast meeting, work right through the day, right through the afternoon, cram the work in because you had to fit in a year's work in kind of a short period of time, and work over dinner and finish. And I decided that we'd take time out and we'd have an hour and a half, 2 hours in the afternoon walking and talking and spending half an hour breaks doing process work. And it was incredible what that board produced over its lifetime, what we did together. It was very, very interesting that you took that time out and you built relationships, you built trust, you reflected on the process. And then the task work was so much more efficient. It was very interesting to kind of see it work in practice.
I love that idea of reflecting in action and reflecting on action and in practice. And I think it's so important to what I call disrupting our habitual practices. So, you know, what you were describing there early on about, you know, getting up early and it's broadly approximating the day and the work life that happens in an organization, you know, like a parallel process. And I think teams need to be able to step back and reflect and go, hang on a minute, is this working, you know? And what is it connected to? I mean, I often see teams so excited by the business of activity and just getting and racing on with activity that they for the sake of what and where does this take us in the cumulative round? So I think that ability to be able to stop, reflect, pause and go, what's happening? You know, what's happening emotionally, what's happening in the field, in the phenomenological field, what's happening between us, the interactions, the relations, what's missing in terms of some of the conversations we're not having. And in addition, you know, what needs refinement vis-a-vis our purpose. You know, I always ask teams four questions when I'm with them. I always ask, you know, what brought you here? Why are you constituted as a team? And what are you expected to deliver? But probably more importantly, you know, when that's clear, I then go, you know, well, what agreements will support you accept responsibility for delivering on those requirements of you? And then what approach are you going to take? And too many times teams don't spend the time to just, you know, constitute themselves well and have team agreements and working agreements and be clear about what it is they're going for, what direction that they have, you know, what's their commitment to that direction and what's the capacity to fulfill it. So they're the kinds of things I will focus on with teams.
Yeah, I mean, I love your idea of disrupting our habitual practices. It's something I talk about a lot in my work about kind of the role of a coach is to be disruptive and because just disruption kind of helps me to kind of think in different ways and look awry as I write in my books. And so much of the task-focused work, we must get this done, it is actually anti-task work. You know, it's called kind of task-focused, but really it's anti-task work and people kind of run around in circles and really don't get the real work done. You know, I often talk about kind of the real work, you know, what's the real work? And sometimes that is actually working on yourself. And sometimes that means bringing in an external person, a coach or somebody out from the outside to kind of shed light on the team process, doesn't it?
You know, I think, Simon, you're speaking of something that's very important. I mean, one of the questions that I've asked probably consistently over the podcast was, you know, what mires a team or what gets in the way? And I'd say if I've had 50 podcasts, maybe 25 have responded, the relentless task nature of teams and, you know, and just taking on more and more, and the paucity of self-reflection, of self-awareness, of team awareness, of self-compassion, of dialogue, and it's just a race to you know, I don't want to say it's a race to the bottom, but it's certainly, you know, in one instance, a guest responded, it's just like, you know, putting petrol in the car and never getting out of the car park because you're just going around in circles, you know, having Tuesday's meeting last week, today again, you know. So I think we do have to disrupt that, and we have to ask, you know, what's getting in the way. You know, I had a conversation on Friday with a lady who's written a book about smart objectives, and it's had a huge, you know, sort of duration as a concept, as a framework. And sometimes, I mean, I asked her about how allergic are people to objectives, because sometimes I am myself. And but there's something in the way of which she was attending to, is that sometimes we carry with us work that is actually not ours anymore, that we need to let go. But it's almost like a comfort blanket. I know how to do this. And as leaders, we tend to keep hanging on to stuff as opposed to letting go and focusing on where's the real value and contribution I should be making at this particular level. So much.
I'm shocked. When I don't know why I'm shocked. I'm experienced enough not to be shocked, but I'm still shocked every time I go into an organization, whether it's a public sector or a corporate, and just the way people use busyness as a defense against looking at themselves, looking at their process, looking at what their real purpose is, looking at kind of what could be different, because it's familiar, because it gets through the day, because you come away with an adrenaline buzz for being so busy. It's a huge kind of defense against the real, against what is needed to be done to both create a more successful team and organization, but also to create a better world.
Oh, Simon, I think you're so right. And you reminded me, I'm smiling here at you because you reminded me of so many of the senior leaders I've coached in the past. And I remember sitting outside a cafe in one in Dublin with one. And, you know, he presided over a European platform and, you know, very senior executive. And the what I was hearing as excuses for his busyness, I said, okay, show me your diary, show me the week, let's just look at it. And I interrogated it, asking him questions that he felt decidedly uncomfortable about answering, you know, where, you know, I was disrupting the notion that actually he had to attend every meeting and his participation was vital to everything. And I was always asking him, and in service of what, and what does that add up to? And, you know, what would your absence mean, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So it's again, I think separating out, as you say, the real work from the busyness that is a defense against actually paying attention to where you're focusing and what is the focus that really needs your attention.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole idea of teams is interesting. I was, you know, Amy Edmondson's work on teaming and the postmodern notion and virtual teams, the way teams are no longer as fixed as they used to be, that they're more changeable. And this impacts on work a lot. What's your experience of moving into this new world of teaming and virtual teams and more transitional teams rather than the idea of a kind of a fixed team you're going to stay with for the next 5 years?
Yeah, so, you know, in a nanosecond, the world has been thrown into a distributed team situation and virtual teams. And we've probably made more progress in the last few months on that concept than a lot of teams thought possible, and especially leaders thought possible, not trusting their teams could be able to be trusted to do the work from home, et cetera. What it has, though, asked of us now is to understand the very word you used that Amy Edmondson used, is the business of teaming and what it means in a virtual world, and how do you collaborate across, you know, models like this, Zoom, etc., and how do you get questions that you would ordinarily say maybe sidle up to somebody at a water cooler and have an informal conversation? How do you do that and create the space and time, and not just be preoccupied with tasks and lists, but actually have conversation and dialogue? So I think it's asking us to be much more present. I think earlier on, Simon, you actually, you know, spoke and voiced on social media the some of the practices that you have to have on the social platforms now, to be wholly present, to have meetings in a different way, and to connect inordinately with people, to be able to listen for emotional undercurrents and emotions. And I think it's asking of leaders a different, it's really asking leaders to become much more human, and to also notice, like, it's easy in an office environment to, you know, oh, maybe that I can feel the climate, but everybody is in their own bubble at home. And so you've got to be more active in thinking, I wonder how Joe is, you know, and reaching out. So it's actively participating in a way that we might not have had to before. And I think Amy Edmondson's work on teaming and psychological safety is even more prescient now in this world. And I think we have to just develop the teaming skills necessary to do this virtual working. And somebody, this lady that I was interviewing, Ariel O'Farrell, on Friday said to me, you know, for people who know their work, like their technical work, this world is easy. But, you know, as the knowledge workers and how you share work, it's a little more difficult in this domain. So there's more learning to be had.
There is. And it puts an extra burden or expectation or need on team leaders, I think. This, I'm working a lot with team leaders, some in the financial sector, some in retail, some in education. And there's a commonality around now we're kind of forced to be more virtual. The team leader's role has to be much more active because there's a lot of individuals in their bubbles, and to do the extra work to build that emotional life of a team, to build the individual support necessary, I think there's a burden on team leaders. And I think as coaches, we really have to kind of focus our work on how can we support team leaders to support their teams.
Yeah, I think we do. And, you know, initially in the first lockdown, I was talking about, you know, revamping teams. And I was talking about just appreciating what it means to be virtual. And the A in VAMP was really about amplifying affinity, you know, to remember that, you know, connections are lost immediately and you have to build them and rebuild them. And you literally have to amplify them because it's a container of anxiety and worry, et cetera, and you have to be able to be with that and still not lose the plot. And so it asks, you know, a lot more of leaders to be so much more present emotionally and socially sensitive and to be much more human and empathize. And then it is as well as to just to be mindful about what needs attention. And of course, maybe even to repurpose, you know, so that's the BAMP. And I got a lot of traction from just that concept, that idea, because it isn't business as usual. And a lot of businesses have to pivot and to re-engineer themselves. And the few teams that I was dealing with at the time, it was probably more impactful on leaders because a lot of their assumptions and preferences and biases were called into question. And especially the trust one, you know, I had to challenge a lot of leaders going, you know, what are you assuming that things won't get done by virtue of this being virtual? And, yeah. Or what are you assuming that this, we can't continue in this team coaching frame because we are virtual? So, and thankfully they took the challenges and we continued working because it's just a reordering of stuff and it's a reprioritization and it's a reappreciation of what and how we need to be online as opposed to how we were in the physical domain, and let go some of our preferences around that and take up what needs to happen in the virtual.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in the resilience of teams, how the idea of teams stays very powerfully with us in organizations. When we move into the network society, you know, my work on eco-leadership, we talk about the business ecosystems, the social ecosystems, the networks people work in. And this is really important because this is very real. You know, we work in these fluid networks and we engage in organizations, beyond organizations, with different stakeholders. And yet teams are still a mainstay of how people work, aren't they? They're still kind of a central kind of cog in the wheel of the organization.
I certainly started to talk about the team as the unit of currency and not the individual. And I firmly believe that, but I think there's a greater and greater emphasis on the notion of team of teams. And which corresponds with the idea of the networked association is that you've got to be conscious of the system in which you're operating and the systemic nature of our world and where things are going. And sort of the maybe unusual or counterintuitive nodes of influence that are out there that you may not have tapped into before. So I think it's just about really raising social awareness and constantly asking questions. And I love your idea of you know, looking awry, because it's often in those places, in the awry, that, you know, insights happen, intuitions happen. I think we've been in a phenomenal learning curve over the last few months in through COVID, and notwithstanding all of the suffering, I think organizationally, hopefully we'll hold on to some of the incredible learning and focus we've derived.
Yeah, this systemic view is very important. We study it a lot in group relations work, where we look at individuals in different group formats and different teams. They join some teams voluntarily. We look at relationships between teams, and then we would look at relationships between the teams and the whole, and the systemic whole. And one thing I did a few years ago, I did a design, and I called it the leadership game. And it's a group relations event for organizations. So I go to an organization and we'd work with between 50 and 100 people at once. And I'd set them into four different team cultures, and they mirror the my leadership frame. So we have one controller leadership group, we have one therapist leadership group, one messiah leadership group, and one eco-ish leadership group. And I give them instructions. So in a controller group, I say, you're in control of this group, you're the leader, you take authority, you make the decisions. In the therapist group, I say you're more democratic, you try and build consensus in the work you do as a team leader. In the messiah group, I select somebody who we say is the most charismatic or transformative person, and that they lead through influence. And then the eco leadership distributes leadership widely. And what shocked me doing this game, and I've done it a number of times, and it's a fantastic learning experience for people, is just how quickly teams fall into those cultures.
Yeah,
they're given. And it really surprised me. I thought, you know, with a controller, you'd either get a lot of resistance. And each group is different. And I've done it internationally, and each country has a different kind of flavor. But generally, people really fit very quickly into their organizational culture. And the second part of the game is that these teams have to come and work together. And it's absolutely fascinating to see them work in their team culture. So they find it very difficult to work together, because we have one team who's got a controller, one who's got a transformative leader, one who's kind of more democratic. And they try and lead this kind of group work together in the way their team's formed. And that's over a period of like 48 hours. And it's just really interesting to see how quickly individuals and teams identify with team cultures and how powerful team cultures are.
I think it sounds like a fantastic exercise. It reminds me of Barry Oshry's lab about tops, middles and bottoms, and the speed at which you become immersed and enmeshed in the culture and the identity of whatever you're assigned, and you play that out and enact out, and how quickly you become entangled in that, and the speed at which you lose sense of yourself in terms of maybe a preference to be otherwise. So I can genuinely, and it just speaks to, I think, so often teams, you know, think that task or think that, you know, strategy is what it is. And it's actually a lot of it is, you know, really unpicking the culture and the, you know, the unspoken or unseen to then be with whatever task and strategy the entity is tasked with. So I think it's an incredible invisible force. And that's why I think more and more, you know, teams could be advantaged by considering, you know, working with coaches or consultants to explore that terrain, because just as your example suggests, you know, we can get so ensnared.
Yeah, and it takes us back to your disrupting habitual patterns, because I've been thinking about this a lot, and you know, you need a really good facilitator, a supervisor. I do supervision for ongoing supervision for teams. Particularly in the HR and OD field, when they're trying to think about the whole organizational system, and to have that outside perspective, a systemic and emotionally aware perspective, is really, really helpful for teams. And you know, so team coaches, supervisors, and when I was working with a board, I started off my work by taking them to Lambay Island. Do you know Lambay Island?
Oh, I do. Of course, I do. Yeah.
So this is for our listeners. This is an island about 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer off the Dublin coast. And it's got one house on it, and it's got deer, and it's got some wallabies jumping around. It's an amazing little nature reserve. And I took my board there to disrupt their thinking. And we went there, and I also took an artist with us. So she wasn't a trained supervisor, facilitator, but she worked and she drew pictures of what our thinking was as we thought. And it was the most inspiring experience, both being in nature and being just going on a boat, going on a journey together, building some team trust. But also this artist is reflecting back with images and pictures. And it's just so powerful. And you know, we could do our own work then. We could kind of reflect on our own process and on our own kind of blocks and our own creativity because this artist was working with us. So it's just this external person reflecting back on a system. It just seems to be really important, I think.
And different modalities using different, you know, parts of our brain to think and to reflect. Like, I love art. I also love constellations. And I like you taking a group to an island. It's just, to me, that is disrupting our habitual patterns and what we're assuming and expecting to have in a day or an offsite. And I love doing that. You know, I don't know about you, Simon, but I use art myself in many of the interventions that I employ with teams to kind of bypass our you know, analytical thinking and to get emotive or to get creative. And I always get that, you know, oh, I can't draw, et cetera, et cetera. But what surfaces then in the end is incredible. And the speed at which you can get at different thinking is important. You know, using intuition, using the gut, using your passions, alternative ways to question. And when we're so used to the habitual cognitive lens. So I think that's fabulous, what you just described.
Yeah, I use art a lot. And I insist on using paper as well. And I use flip chart paper if I can, like large sheets, you know, if I'm doing network mapping. There's plenty of stuff you can do on computers. But that kind of 12-inch screen or 15-inch screen in front of you, it kind of puts it makes you think smaller. It makes you think in a different way. And having a big piece of paper, which is white and empty, and having flip chart markers or crayons or pastels, and getting people to work and saying, don't worry about being an artist, just kind of see what comes straight out of your mind, and then we reflect on it. Massively powerful.
And I'm reminded of our, you know, our event with you when I was studying with you, and we sat on the floor. And I do that a lot with groups, you know, not to do, you know, the sort of formal sitting around chairs behind desks. I mean, I never have a desk in any room I'm working with. And, you know, initially teams will be very threatened by that. You know, they don't have a natural defense to sit behind. And invariably, you know, by mid-morning, they're on the floor. And I think there are all the ways and practices that you can disrupt thinking.
There are, and it's really important. And I mean, one thing I've been thinking a lot about as well with the COVID, and even before COVID, when we were working more global and dispersed teams, is how we offer containment in new ways, because the classic work from Bion and the Tavistock and group relations movements is about offering containment through very clear roles, very clear boundaries, clear tasks. But in this new world, there's a much more fluidity there, and that's a reality of it. You know, the world has become more fluid, whether it's about our gender, whether it's about our political lives, whether it's about kind of the way we work with teams. There is faster movement and there is displacement and there is a kind of a fluidity. And I think to go along with that, we have to think about new ways of containment, new ways about how we contain people's emotions, how we can think about structural containment, how we can think about emotional containment, and how we do that in new ways. And I wonder if you've explored any of that in your work.
So, that was the word I was actually looking for, that I think was an article that you shared about containment. And I think you're right. I think, you know, one of the ways that you talk structural, you talk emotional, and there are many forms and ways of getting at containment. And I think one of the groundswells for containment is acceptance. And so I work a lot with teams to just accept, you know, where things are at, and things are messy and fluid, because invariably they'll jump at, this is not what we're used to. This is, there'll be all that defensive reactions too. And allowing then, you know, just the allowing of stuff to go awry or to go messy or to not be so beautifully contained in a perfect formula. And to get comfortable with expressing emotions. And I don't know if I'm speaking to the idea of containment here, but Simon, so you might share into it but I think acknowledging first of all that there is difference, and then appreciating and allowing for that. And you know, the amplification I spoke of earlier can help in terms of affinity, in terms of containment, is just to allow more voice and to allow more expression and to accept where we are, and put in, and then to ask about the practices that might be needed to support, you know, comfort and new thinking, or allowing thinking to progress. I think one of the ways that I have held groups a little bit more is by, you know, one, acknowledging our current existence and not denying it, but then also just holding the space for optimism, because notwithstanding everything that's happening in the context in which we sit, there's still gaps and possibility. So as a coach and a team coach, just holding optimism and holding and encouraging, you know, I certainly celebrate when I see opportunities and places to move, and to be solutions focused, and then to be forward moving it with a team, can give teams the sense of okayness, that even in the space of yuckiness, we can still do something.
Sure. I mean, the way I think about containment, I mean, I agree with everything you said. When I did my master's many years ago at the Tavistock, I wrote a paper called Where's Daddy? And it's about reintroducing paternal containment, which is also known as structural containment in my language. And a lot of people kind of split this off. So a lot of people will focus on clear agendas, clear purpose, clear contracting, time boundaries. And that structural containment is creating a safe space to work. But mixing that up with the what is called in psychoanalysis is maternal containment or emotional containment. It's very much about how a mother contains an infant who's upset. And it's not through anything more than their body posture, their emotional language, their tone of voice, their managing of their own anxiety to understand what the infant is projecting upon them.
Yeah.
So to understand what an infant needs, you have to manage your own anxiety. If you're too anxious as a parent, you'll jump in and you'll push a bottle into them, or you'll change a nappy. You'll just get active, and you'll be very active. And we see this in teams and team leaders. They jump in and they try and make decisions very quickly when they get anxious. And to understand what's going on for the infant or your team members, you have to step back, manage your own anxiety, contain your own anxiety, and turn emotions into thinking. So there's this magic piece called emotions into thinking, where we understand our transference, our counter-transference, understand the emotions, what's going on in the team, explore them with the team, create a safe space where they can work on their emotions, and then the team themselves turn emotions into thinking, and then we turn thinking into action. And this is a step. So we need the structural containment to create a safe space to work, to allow the emotions to come to surface. And then we need to make space for the emotions to do their work. And then we need to turn the emotions into thinking by containing our anxiety, creating meaning, and then turning that into action. And that's the kind of process I work with in my supervision groups, in my team coaching groups.
And I think what you've just articulated there, Simon, maybe is a reflection, it was my clumsy reflection, but I think what you've just shared there is, you know, it's not enough to just have the paternal containment. You have to have the maternal containment, and you have to be able to give the team space to process these emotions. And then, as you say, turn them into thinking, but not dumb them down. I think in the anxiety or in the not liking or the stuck sense, the habitual patterns that often happen on teams is that they'll ignore them or suppress them or push them away, or as you say, the team leader will jump in. So I think it's a both, it's an and.
I totally agree. Tara, we're running out of time. We could go on and on and on. This is a hugely interesting subject. It's been really fascinating. As you know, I ask my guests the final question. What from this conversation and from your experience of working with teams can you share with our audience to think about how to live a good life and to create a good society? Any thoughts?
I think the word that comes to mind is care. I think I've been reminded of, you know, kindness and care as being the two words that I really became more familiar with through COVID and through the last year. And in terms of, you know, living the good life, is just to be appreciative, to care for the other, and to wonder behind the judgment what might be happening. You know, we're too quick in our brilliance as individuals and as teams to judge without actually inquiring, and to have that sort of curiosity that, you know, most coaches think they're invested with, but to really be avidly curious and caring of the other. I'm probably using a lot of words now as opposed to just one, but that's my offer, to be really wildly curious. And to maybe suspend judgment for a nanosecond to wonder.
Lovely. To be caring, to be curious.
Yeah.
That's been fabulous listening to you. I recommend your podcast to everybody listening here, A Game of Teams. It's fabulous to learn about what's going on, and you're interviewing some really interesting people. So thanks very much for your thoughts today, and I look forward to working with you in the future, Tara.
Oh, Simon, it's been a fabulous opportunity. And back at you, I love your Edgy Ideas podcast. So for anybody listening, must remember that it's a fabulous one. And it's been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training and events, please contact Simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.